You're listening to The Profile.
Welcome to The Profile podcast. God calls us to use our influence to share his love and goodness. For some, this is in leadership. I'm Andy Peck, and for the past 19 years, I've been interviewing Christians to find out how to lead better. Taking the initiative isn't always easy, so I hope you'll benefit from this latest conversation. The Profile podcast is brought to you by Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe today and get full online access and the print magazine every month at premierchristianity.com.
I wonder whether you are currently making the most of artificial intelligence, also known as AI. You can be sure that AI is an invisible part of your world without you knowing it, as companies you buy from and interact with utilize its benefits. But as a Christian in leadership, are you leading faster and better because of it? Or maybe you regard it as something of an enemy, a part of a world that you don't want to enter. You have principled ethical objections to the notion. Well, I'm delighted to be joined today by someone who's going to help us navigate AI. Simon Cross left his role as an airline pilot to research technology ethics and the regulatory and governance challenges that AI poses for society. And he wrote a Grove book entitled Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for the Perplexed. He's now the Reverend Dr. Simon Cross and works in the Bishop of Oxford's office, Parliamentary Affairs Department specialising in AI and technology with the Church of England's Faith and Public Life team. That's a bit of a mouthful, so we'll be unpacking that job description as we go in the conversation. So welcome, Simon. Lovely to have you on the show.
Andy, lovely to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So why the interest in this field, Simon?
It brings together three sweet spots in my life, I think, Andy. First of all, I am impeccably curious. I just can't stop. I wonder how things work, and not just how technology works, but also how the world works. And AI is such a diffuse thing. It impacts on so many different aspects of culture and economics and politics and all kinds of things. Secondly, I've always been very interested in philosophy and those questions that remain even after we've finished with the physics and the mathematics and the statistics. And the second thing is I am a deacon in the Church of England, and the deacon has a very specific role, which when I see it written down, I recognise in myself. I think the deacon's task is to stand right on the doorway between the church and the world and to bring both of those worlds into a fruitful and meaningful dialogue with each other. And boy, does AI do all of that.
Oh, fabulous. Yeah, sounds, what a great answer. Let's tackle your job title. You work in the Bishop of Oxford's office. I guess there's an office somewhere where the Bishop of Oxford operates. But then Parliamentary Affairs Department, which specialises in AI and technology. Unpack that for us.
Yes, I know. You can see people running at cocktail parties, and as I unfold my business card to the eighth time. But it's a job that's evolved over the last 5.5 years. So I was originally recruited because the Bishop of Oxford is one of 26 bishops who sit in the House of Lords. He's been there since about 2014. He developed an interest in artificial intelligence and was therefore invited to participate in an AI select committee and something called an all-party parliamentary group. And as there are a relatively small number of lords who are beginning to, or were beginning to specialise in technology, he was then invited to become a founding member of something called the Centre for Data Ethics and Innovation, which the government created in, I think, about 2019. So I was originally recruited just on a 2-year fixed term contract with a view principally to supporting him in that role, but also then feeding some of the learning from that out to the diocese. But it was discovered quite quickly, Andy, that I just wasn't needed. There was a very strong secretariat supporting him in that role. It coincided with the government producing what at the time was called an online harms white paper, which turned into the online safety bill, which then rumbled through Parliament for a number of years. So I became quite involved in supporting the Church of England more broadly as it was feeding into government consultations and then specific regulation. And That also coincided with this huge explosion in what everyone now calls AI. And so the role has expanded. I've been given a huge, huge privilege to go almost where I want to try and explore this cluster of complicated issues. But said shortly, my role, I think, involves three strands at this point. So first and foremost, I support 26 bishops, as I say, who sit in the House of Lords, who actually scrutinise regulation and legislation and have potentially some influence on government policy. Second thing is that I support the Church of England as an institution more broadly, trying to add my expertise and some policy advice as and where it's wanted and useful, and trying to educate Christians in the diocese and more broadly again about what is, I think, quite a complicated set of issues around AI. And then the third and final strand, Andy, is that I work at the intersection of the church with civil society. And again, I think this is the deacon part of me coming out. So there are a cluster of organizations, small mostly, who are really interested in trying to form and reform this technology for the public good. And I work with and alongside them, both analysing the risks and harms as well as the benefits and trying to shape policy and responses. So, again, a horribly long answer to a short question. But the privilege for me, Andy, is that I really have got to go where I want and form a job as opportunity has allowed in a field that's just expanding all the time.
So, but I was going to ask you why the role was created, but you've wonderfully answered that as we've progressed. But it's good to hear that there's concern within Parliament of the ethical dimension to this. And I guess a lot of folk, without even without faith, would say that there's an alarming dimension to artificial intelligence. And obviously, there's lots of dimensions to that. There's a the more simple dimension of logarithms and that kind of stuff, but there's ethical dimensions to robots taking over and the kind of fear mongering that takes place in people's minds. So we maybe explore some of that as we go. Do you understand why Christians are reluctant to engage with AI?
I think that's a very interesting question. And I think that at the moment, Andy, it's mostly anecdotal evidence. I'm not sure I've read of any really clear polling on exactly what Christian attitudes are specifically. But the government do a tracking poll of public attitudes to AI. They released their most recent wave 4, as it's called, just at the end of last year. And some of the numbers there are quite interesting. Only 43% of the general public feel that AI is going to have a positive impact on society. Around 33% are actually quite concerned about it. And about 39% think it's going to have a positive impact on them individually, whereas 29% think it's going to have a negative impact on them personally. And around 20% of people are just agnostic at this point.
Right,
My
okay.
suspicion is that those numbers are broadly reflected amongst Christians as well. So the jury is out a little bit. But what I do find interesting, Andy, is actually what I encounter quite a lot in my day-to-day life is a really strong binary between Christians who are incredibly reluctant about this, maybe excessively reluctant, and other Christians who might have an excessive enthusiasm. And I think it's worth unpacking both sides of that a little bit. Why might Christians be excessively reluctant? It seems to me that if you're confronted with something that you are told is both mysterious and powerful, that can be quite intimidating. What on earth does that mean? And then if you're told this stuff is going to change your life, but you know that you don't know anything at all about computer programming, and you're terrified because every time anybody mentions GDPR, you just think there's a problem with your email list. And you'd think that you have to have some good quality data of your own before you can use this technology. All of those things, I think, feel like barriers to people, understandably so. And then, of course, there are stories regularly now in the press about the kinds of harms and inadvertent consequences of this kind of technology. So I do understand a strong reluctance from some Christians to engage with this stuff, but I wouldn't want that to be excessive. And then I look at the flip side of that and I'm struck by an excessive, what strikes me as an excessive enthusiasm at times. And I think, again, Andy, for some people, that combination of mystery and power can be quite attractive. I think also there is this problem with FOMO, a fear of missing out in a culture which is so obsessed with the new and the bright and the shiny. And then I also think that some Christians are afraid of being accused of being Luddites, of being out of touch with culture and reality, and being old-fashioned and being naysayers. So how do I balance those competing tensions? My advice to leaders is to go back to first principles. It seems to me that in the New Testament, we have always been called to exercise discernment with the things of the world. Whether that's how we choose to organize our church services or whether it's how we choose what we buy when we go down to the local market. And it seems to me that good stewardship is about discernment that's oriented around three dimensions. How are we being good stewards to ourself? How are we being good stewards in relation to our neighbours? And how are we being good stewards of whatever we're given in relation to our relationship with God? And those, for me, are the orienting poles which avoid excessive enthusiasm and excessive reluctance.
I'm aware that, Simon, that we haven't strictly defined what artificial intelligence is. We've kind of hinted at it. I should have asked this earlier, but give us a kind of a sort of a definition and the scope of it, because there's elements of it that probably most of us would think, well, that's fair, that's fine, and then there's elements that are a little bit more alarming, aren't there?
And I think there's a very good reason why it's taken us until now even to try and define what AI is, Andy. That's because it's a very, very nebulous term. I would say those of us who've been working in this space for a few years now, we always used to use the term AI a little bit archly a few years ago, and then we would rush to clarify what version of machine learning we meant by that. But that horse has bolted. It's such a ubiquitous term now. My way of describing AI to people is to suggest that it's a cluster or a suite of different tools and techniques that all have one fundamental thing in common. They're statistical inference engines. So you feed lots of data into them, and then in the unseen background, they use some very, very, very clever versions of statistical manipulation to either predict, to classify, or predict. For some kind of activity, what the next piece of data is going to be. So they're prediction engines and they just depend on statistics. It's fundamentally, it's clever maths that's really at work here. And that's what AI is. And once we understand that, I think that punctures some of the mystery. And it helps us, I think, then to begin to tease apart the benefits, potential benefits, which are very considerable, but also the potential risks and harms, which are not insignificant either.
What kind of things might AI assist us with? How might a leader today suddenly think, "Well, I'm going to embrace this." What are the what could it usefully use? I mean, most of us have, if we use Google, AI will come up with an answer if we're asking a question. So we know that that's done a little bit of work behind the scenes, getting of all the thousands and thousands of pieces of information, it's sifting through and giving us an answer to our question.
I think people are overwhelmed, Andy. And my role here, I think, is to help people to take a step back and look at the big picture so that they can then begin to work through for themselves, well, which particular tool or technique might be helpful for me. So let's start with the biggest context of all. What are the economic and, in fact, what are the cultural drivers that are at work here? What are the pressures, the unseen or unspoken pressures on the leaders to pick up and run with this stuff? Well, first of all, there has been the most astronomical amount of investment in this kind of technology. And it's notable that 2025 is the year where those who've invested heavily are now starting to bang the drum for a return on their investment. So
Right.
there's a certain amount of pressure to turn investment into revenue streams, which converts into pressure on leaders to buy or adopt services and tools. And again, there is a rush to grab market share because it turns out that there's something called a network effect, and because there's something called moating, which means if you can rush to market and grab a big chunk of market, you have a huge advantage over all the people that try and follow behind you. The third element, I think, besides the money and the benefits to first mover, are that it's easy to make really bold and sweeping promises about what this technology can do, and then veil those promises in a kind of technical complexity so that when people say, well, how exactly is it going to do that? You can bamboozle them a little bit with your very clever mathematics. And then again, this tendency to either excessive caution or optimism that we've already discussed. But what that means, I think, Andy, is that it's actually quite unclear what the risks and vulnerabilities of a certain tool or service are until it's already out there and until people are rushing to use it and until it's been used a while. And so what I think leaders at the moment are ending up with is quite a complicated interlocking set of factors they have to weigh, because for sure, these new tools are a good deal more powerful than Excel or Word. And so again, my suggestion to leaders who are wrestling with this and wondering quite how to make sense of any of it is to say, well, let's reframe the question. Let's actually start at the end. What kind of church do you want? What kind of service are you trying to build? What kind of charity do you want? What does the end point of good look like for you? And try and be as granular as you can about that answer, because I think that what happens when people are very granular about where they're trying to get to is they come up with a set of qualities they want, not just a set of quantities. And once you've got that list, once you've got that list of qualities and quantities, well, then you're in a much better position to judge whether this particular tool or this particular service is going to help or is going to harm that end goal. Said otherwise, don't say, what can I do with this new and shiny tool everyone says is going to be a game changer? Rather say, what game am I trying to play here? And is this particular tool or service going to help me reach that end or not? Because then I think you have some really clear criteria. But what I don't underestimate, Andy, is how deceptively countercultural what I've just suggested is, because there are these really powerful pressures on leaders to be innovative and to be constantly reinventing and be offered this apparent solution, which is actually, in truth, a little bit untested and untried.
That's really helpful, Simon. That's I think that's a key learning from this is that look, sit down and do some thinking before you even start to investigate.
Yeah, because once you've got that list of key goals, then it becomes easier to say of a particular tool or service, okay, what are the pros and cons here? Now I can research this. I can see exactly what people are finding this really helpful for. I can see where people are discovering some of either the weaknesses or failure points with this. And now I can loop back and have a look at my end goals and say, well, no, actually, this tool is still a little bit too juvenile or a little bit too unreliable to help. I'm going to wait until there's a better version of this. Or to say, oh no, hang on a minute, this is really good. This could save me time without costing me quality. Andy, one of the realities in all of this is that there are always going to be trade-offs, and people should be clear about what they're trading and what they're trading for.
Right, sure. I've you mentioned earlier you weren't too sure exactly how Christians had embraced this or not, and I guess that would be the same answer when I ask how the Church of England as a whole is embracing it, and particularly clergy. I mean, I've in the early days when it became more common to talk about AI, I've seen services constructed using AI and sermons, and people are saying this really looks quite good. So, what's your take on Church of England clergy take up of this?
Again, all of the evidence at the moment is anecdotal. My sense is there's a real wave of both interest but also concern about quite what the risks and harms are. The standard question I've been asked for a good couple of years now is it okay to use ChatGPT to write a sermon?
Yes.
Again, it seems to me that leadership is about modelling best practice. And I think, again, another way to frame the benefits of AI is to think about it in terms of augmentation. Is this particular tool or technique going to augment? Is it going to increase and help to multiply and flourish the work that we're doing or the goal that we're trying to achieve? Or is it actually going to subtly undermine that? So I would draw a little bit on my experience as an airline pilot here and say that automation at its best would make my job both easier and safer and more enjoyable. But automation at times could lead me astray and could do things which it was entirely programmed to do. It was behaving exactly as it was intended to, but would actually undermine my sense of quite where I was going or what I was doing. And that same principle applies to leadership generally, I think, Andy. I'm struck by Jesus' phrase in the New Testament to his disciples that we need to be as wise as serpents and as innocent as doves. And it's that first part that really gets my attention. I think many of us Christians, we slightly balk at the idea that we're supposed to emulate the serpent in any particular way. But it's a really interesting saying. And again, I think what Jesus means by that is be discerning, be critical, be thoughtful about which bits you pick up, which bits you use and employ, and which bits actually you steer away from. And the innocent and as doves part, I think, is the moral component here. There are moral aspects to the way that AI is produced. So there are question marks, Andy, about the theft of intellectual property. There are profound question marks around payment for data labeling and the offshoring of some pretty unpleasant or mundane work to people in other parts of the world who are paid nothing at all. There are profound questions, Andy, about the actual energy and indeed water costs of designing all of this stuff. And so there are, I think, an important set of moral questions that leaders ought to be aware of and ought to be weighing as they're deciding how to integrate these particular tools.
So, Simon, where are things heading? What we maybe need to be concerned about as Christians as we head into this new world? And I'm going to ask you also about books and resources that might help us navigate. But just give us a bit of a few pointers, perhaps.
And so I think this technology is going to be embedded profoundly in the world around us in the same way that Excel and Word have now become completely normal, and email is now a completely normative part of most leaders' working and personal lives. I think increasingly going on AI in whatever and various forms is going to become like that way, also embedded. I think there are two things I would flag for leaders about significant changes afoot. The first is there is a lot of hype, I think, and a lot of interest, a lot of enthusiasm about things called AI agents. And this is a way of bolting together different aspects of large language models or chatbots and using them as servants, in effect. So you say to your agent, I'd like you to go away and, for example, book flights to New York for me. And the agent goes away and looks at your diary and goes online and basically does this whole task for you. It's a huge amount of excitement in the industry about developing agents. The problem or the risk is that it's an untried and untested technology. And would you really want to give a really untried and untested technology full access to your bank account when you can't be 100% certain quite what it's going to do? I wonder, Andy, whether the idea of AI agents actually might turn out to be a little bit like autonomous vehicles. And I'm speculating here because I'm not sure anybody quite knows the answer to this. But the thing about autonomous vehicles is, in principle, they look relatively easy. And so there's been this sense year on year for however many years now that the technology is just another 12 months away. I wonder whether some of the development of AI agents is actually going to be harder to complete than it initially looks. But we live in a world where artificial intelligence is occupying a regulatory vacuum. And what that means is that companies are in a position to develop and deploy tools without any particular sense of a duty of care, so often without doing any really significant risk assessment, and also where they haven't really done much or any product safety testing. And so there are risks about picking up and running with these kinds of tools and services in that bigger context, Andy. And so I would caution just not to rush too much into these things, but to be sure that you understand what the benefits are, but again, what the failure points, what some of the potential risks or downsides of a very new and cutting-edge technology might be. The second thing I think is actually the slightly more concerning one. It's the fact that there is now an astronomical amount of evidence to show that we cannot help but form really profound personal bonds with something that so perfectly mimics being a human being like us.
Well.
And there is, I think, some concern that the next iteration of the web is not what's called the attention economy. That sense, if I get your attention and I design addiction to the phone so that you're always picking it up and scrolling, the next version of Web3 might be, because these tools are so very powerfully bonding, actually something a bit more like an affection economy or even an intention economy, where first of all, we give away so much more information about who we are and what we care about and what we might be doing and thinking in the future. But secondly, we're much more open to manipulation. And that, I think, is something that we're going to want to think very, very carefully about as Christians. What we do with these tools, which mimic certain aspects of human being, but which are fundamentally inhuman, is I think going to be quite a pressing question for Christians as they try and roll these tools and services up into their own work and lives, but also as they see what's going on in the lives of those around them.
Well, thank you, Simon. That's very salutary thoughts there. Just as we close, I encourage people obviously to get your book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for the Perplexed. Grove Books are just wonderful value for money. So people can find that online. Any other particular books that you would recommend?
This is the hardest question you've asked me, Andy, because I think we're moving, actually, we're moving from a tr we're transitioning from one status to another. The books that have been published and that I've read over the last few years from a Christian perspective have been quite big picture, quite philosophical, quite conceptual. So they've wrestled with questions of theology and artificial intelligence and things like that. People are much more interested in the very practical, hang on a minute, what does this thing do? And is this going to help or hinder me? And I'm not sure there's a huge amount so far that's really helping to answer that question. Although I am conscious that in the Christian space, more and more people are trying to think through carefully what a fair use policy for AI needs to consist of. If I were making some recommendations to leaders who really wanted to frame or put some bigger context on this whole thing, I would recommend the Ada Lovelace Institute. I'd recommend the Alan Turing Institute. The Joseph Rowntree Foundation have just done a couple of years of work on AI. And the British Academy have just published a series of papers on what a good digital society looks like. So, from the bigger cultural piece, there is some really good thinking going on about how best to utilize these tools and services. And then, if people want a more specifically Christian approach, then I think you would find on the AI Christian Partnership website a good list of resources. Although, full disclosure, I'm a member of that particular group. The Faraday Institute in Cambridge also have some really good resources on AI from a Christian perspective. And if people are really desperate, I've just launched an AI newsletter through Oxford Diocese, and people could, I'm sure, find that and sign up through the diocese. That's more specifically regulatory and policy focused. But there are a range of resources, and I'm optimistic, Andy, because I think more and more is going to emerge, and more practical advice is going to emerge over the coming months. So there will be stuff out there for people who want to understand this and really want to get the best out of it.
Well, Simon, you've given some full and fascinating answers to my questions. So thank you so much. And thank you for being there and in the parliamentary world to argue the Christian case and the ethical cases for some of these developments. So really, really grateful for your work.
Thanks, Andy. Much obliged to you.
It was super to chat with the Reverend Dr. Simon Cross, who works in the Bishop of Oxford's office, looking particularly at AI and technology within the Church of England. Those details again of places to go for more information: the Ada Lovelace Institute, the Alan Turing Institute, the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, the British Academy, and the AI Christian Partnership, of which Simon is a part. Also the Faraday Institute, and Simon himself produces a newsletter from the Oxford Diocese. I'm sure you'll want to look at all that information, or at least some of it, and discover for yourself what effect AI may be having both on you and on the people that you serve. So may God help us all to navigate wisely in these challenging but exciting days. This is Andy Peck thanking you for your company. And looking forward to the next time. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.